This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. A little later this hour, we'll be talking canine communication and cognition. How do dogs pick up on our gestures, our speech, even our moods? If you've got a question, you can give us a call at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. Yesterday, there was a big explosion on Launchpad 40 at Cape Canaveral, Florida, where a SpaceX rocket was being prepared for a test. Oh my, no one was injured, but the rocket and its payload were destroyed. Joining me now to talk about that and some other stories from the week is Sophie Bushwick. She's a senior editor at Popular Science Magazine here in New York. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
So tell us more about this explosion. What happened?
Well, they were doing a static fire test, which is where they clamp the rocket to the launch pad, and then they fire each of its engines for a few seconds just to make sure everything's functioning properly. And the problem is that when they do this type of test, they already have the payload on the rocket. So when the rocket exploded, the payload, which was a satellite they were supposed to launch on Saturday, was destroyed. And another thing about the payload is that Facebook was planning to use it to provide satellite internet access to certain areas of the African continent. And that's down the drain now.
So not just a bad day for Elon Musk, but a bad day for Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, this is a big day for Facebook.
Yeah, and it's a problem for their goal. I mean, Facebook has stated it's one of their goals to provide internet access to everyone, and they're trying a lot of different avenues to do it, but it looks like this satellite method has definitely had a big setback because of its destruction.
You know, when I saw this explosion, I was worried, you know, was anybody hurt? Was anybody killed? I didn't realize how far away people have to be because of the possibility of just such a thing.
Absolutely. Like, they have a lot of safety measures in place, and there's a reason for those measures, because when you're testing a rocket or actually launching the rocket, there are so many things that could go wrong.
Does it set back SpaceX at all? I mean, what do we think?
It could be. SpaceX has been making... SpaceX is trying to launch a reusable rocket, and this was not one of those tests. This was a rocket that hadn't been launched before. But it is every time they have an explosion or there's a setback with one of their rockets, it's not only damaging in terms of financial damage, but it's also damaging in terms of credibility. You want to be able to trust them to eventually take humans to space, and that's a big problem if you can't trust that they're... rockets won't explode.
Ugh. Well, let's move on. And you've got a story about the size of our brains.
Yes. So human beings over the course of our evolution got a lot more intelligent. And researchers used to think that was just because our brains got bigger. But it turns out that while our brains increased by about 350%, the blood supply to our brains actually increased by 600%.
Wow.
And so it might be that the blood supply, our brains now use about 10 gallons of blood an hour. That could be the key to the evolution of human intelligence.
10 gallons of blood an hour? Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty fascinating.
They're bloodthirsty.
Okay. You've got to explain this one to me. This next story sounds like science fiction. Brain-controlled medical nanobots. Okay, tell me about this.
This is pretty much science fiction.
Okay.
So when you put a drug into the bloodstream, you can't really control its release. So researchers made these little nanobots out of a DNA shell, and they put the drugs in the shell. So they are not active when you put them into the body. But if you can open up that shell, which is done by exposing it to electromagnetic energy, then the drug is released. And the way they control whether the energy goes on or off is through the brain. So a human wore an EEG cap that measured his brain activity, and they trained a computer algorithm to recognize when he was doing mathematical calculations in his head. And when he did those calculations, it turned on an electromagnetic coil around a cockroach. The cockroach had been injected with these nanobots. So when the electromagnetic coil went on, the nanobots in the cockroach had this fluorescent molecule so that they opened up and the molecule became active and the cockroach, they could see that the experiment had worked.
Okay, so hold it. So this cockroach experiment, what does this tell us about how medicine is going to work maybe not next year, but soon?
So let's take, for an example, someone who has schizophrenia. And when they're going to have a violent episode, their brain goes into a certain state. You could train an EEG headset to recognize when they were about to have a violent episode, and that would activate an electromagnetic coil, which would turn on the drugs in their bloodstream.
Okay.
But that would only happen if it was necessary. The rest of the times, the drugs wouldn't be active, and so they wouldn't, you wouldn't have to worry about side effects.
So this sounds like a really great science fiction story, but how far away is something like this? I mean, when we see a test like this cockroach test, does it point to something that could be a field of research that will turn up a new type of medicine soon, or is this really way far out?
It's a promising idea, but I'd say it's still pretty far out. First of all, you've got to shrink down. An EEG cap isn't something you want to go around wearing all the time. So you've got to be able to shrink down that technology, which researchers are working on. But the other thing is that, you know, they had these nanobots in a cockroach, which is much smaller than a human, and they had the cockroach inside the electromagnetic coil that was being switched on and off. So with humans, we're not walking around inside an electromagnetic coil. So you're going to have to find an alternative way of delivering this energy that'll open up the nanobots.
But still promising and still kind of cool to think about.
Oh, it's super cool.
Okay, so we're going to finish with a story that it's cool, but it's kind of gross. And it has to do with maybe an alternative form of butter.
Yeah, I do believe it's not butter, but it is mealworms.
Mealworms.
Right. These Dutch researchers, this is reported by Ryan Mandelbaum, and he found that these Dutch researchers are finding ways to take fat extracted from mealworms and to get solids out of it, solid fat. They take the fat and they cool it down by degrees and solid and liquid fat forms. And so you could use these as substitutes. The solid could be a substitute for margarine or butter. The liquid could be a substitute maybe for cooking oil. And it has about the makeup of nutrients that you would get in a mix of soybean and canola oil. But mealworms are very sustainable to raise. They're much more sustainable than cows, for example. And so the idea is this would be good for the environment. And then you'd also be having a product that's no trans fats and low in saturated fats.
But here's the thing. Will people eat mealworm butter?
Well, cultures all over the world eat bugs, and I myself have cooked with cricket flour before. I made pizza dough with cricket flour, and I served it as dinner to my friends, and they were a little weirded out at first, but they got over it. And I think that we can get over it too.
I guess I just should ask, we might get over it maybe at a certain point. Is this going to happen anytime soon? I mean,
there's already restaurants in New York that serve bugs. And so I think that it's already happening.
Okay. Maybe it's already happening. It's not going on my toast anytime soon. Sophie Bushwick is a senior editor at Popular Science Magazine here in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. If tank tops and shorts aren't enough to keep you cool in the summer heat, then you might be in luck. Stanford researchers have engineered a new type of fabric they say can bring your body temperature down by almost 4 degrees. A less sweaty commute to work? Who wouldn't want that? But what it's made of could have you feeling a little bit uncomfortable in other ways. Here to tell us about the good and the bad of this cooling fabric is our guest. Alex Osola is a freelance science journalist and a contributor to Vocative. Alex, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so tell us about this new fabric. What's it made out of exactly?
So the idea is that normal clothes, your shorts, tank tops, they can make you kind of hot when it's really hot out because they trap infrared heat. So this material, it has pores that will release that heat, plus there are other types of holes in it that will sort of wick the moisture away from your body, cooling you off.
Okay. We've got some fabrics that are kind of like that now. I mean, we can buy a golf shirt or something that will wick moisture. How is this different than the clothes that are on the market right now?
Well, the key is in what it's made of, which is polyethylene. It's actually found in plastic wrap. But the way the researchers came about this particular material is that it's also used in batteries and it keeps them from shorting. So it's already being mass produced. They found this sort of nanoporous material. And in order to make it sort of more comfortable and better to release heat, they did a couple of things. They punched holes in it with a microneedle, so that makes it more breathable to better resemble something like cotton. And then they also doused it with this chemical called polydopamine, and that makes it more permeable to water so that it wicks away the moisture, as we discussed before. So to make it even closer to resemble fabrics that we already have on the market, there are three layers. They took the two layers of the material that they made and they put a little cotton mesh in between. The idea is that it's stronger and that it'll hold up like real clothes.
So it's plastic wrap with little tiny holes in it with a little cotton layer in between, and it's going to keep you cool. How much cooler is it going to keep you?
4 degrees, the researchers found when they tested it in the lab. But they said it could be commercialized within 3 to 5 years. So there are a lot more tests that they still have to do. There are things that they don't really know yet, like how comfortable it might be. And to be clear, it is not as see-through as plastic wrap, so you don't have to worry about that.
Well, you talk about the good thing, bad thing about this. Obviously, it would be good to stay cooler, but 4 degrees, first of all, doesn't sound like a whole lot. I mean, is 4 degrees enough to, I don't know, keep me that much cooler on a hot day?
Well, I mean, the researchers didn't really write that much about this, but in my mind, okay, if it's 85 degrees, 4 degrees is going to make a big difference. But if it's 105 with like 100% humidity, I'm not really sure that the wicking is going to do a whole lot of good. The researchers in their paper sort of touted this from the perspective of if it prevents us from turning on the AC or saves a little bit of energy, this could be a really good solution for the growing need for climate change and people in hot places.
Oh, so this is like a sort of a climate change mitigation clothing factor, right? You don't have to cool a building as much because people are wearing cooler clothes.
Exactly.
Why don't you just, you know, wear other cooler clothes? I mean, is this really going to revolutionize anything in the garment industry? Are there other things like this maybe that are coming soon too?
Yeah, so there are some competing projects. What they're made of is a little bit different. And I think it's a lofty goal to get people to try to change their behavior. I mean, if it saves a little bit of energy, it might be worth it. But in the end, it might not stop people from needing to turn on a fan or AC.
And they're not exactly sure if this is going to be comfortable, right? It's made out of plastic wrap. And so the question is, well, I'll ask you, Alex, would you wear a shirt made out of plastic wrap?
You know, I really struggle in the summer, and if it was going to keep me cooler, then yeah, I would do it. But I can't say that it'll keep me from turning on my air conditioner necessarily.
Well, maybe we can look for this sometime soon on the shelves. Alex Osola is a freelance science journalist and a contributor to Evocative. Thanks so much for bringing us this story. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
After the break, when you point and tell your dog to sit, how is the brain processing that command? We'll talk about canine communication, and I'm sure you may have some thoughts. You can call us at 844-724-8255 or 844-SCI-TALK. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. If you're a dog person, you know your dog isn't just hearing your commands. They're listening to what you say and how you say it. Those little side-to-side head movements they make when you talk, you know, you probably tried to trick them by changing the tone of your voice now and again. A group of researchers tested this pet owner's hunch. They measured the brain activity of dogs and confirmed that you should watch what you say and how you say it around your dog. The study was published yesterday in the journal Science. Speech isn't the only kind of human-canine communication, of course. Dogs can clue into our gestures and even our moods. Communication is a two-way street. How do dogs communicate with us? How do we communicate with them? Here to discuss all this is Attila Andic, who's one of the authors of this paper in Science. He's a neuroscientist at Eötvös Loránd University in Budapest, Hungary. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon.
And I also want to welcome in Alexandra Horowitz, who's a psychology professor, leads the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College here in New York. She's also author of the forthcoming book, Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell. She joins us here in our studios in New York. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How do you figure out what your dog is trying to communicate? You can call us at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. I'm sure a lot of dog lovers will be calling us in just a moment with their questions. Attila, though, I have to ask you first, before anything else, I know you've been asked this. One of the first questions that came from us is, how do you train a dog to lay still in an fMRI machine to actually be part of this test? You put headphones on them. Explain how you got them to do this.
Yeah, it's an amazing process, actually. I think what we have to tell them, we have to explain them, is that we want them to be happy volunteers in this scanner and nothing else. It's a very easy task they have to do. They just have to lie completely motionless and do nothing. And when they understand that, okay, it's nothing else, just this, It's working then. Basically, we do a step-by-step positive reinforcement procedure with social learning technique, meaning that it's not only one dog, but also another observing dog who is there, seeing the one on the scanner bed being praised and so, and feeling, oh, I'm so jealous, I want to be the next one there at the place of happiness. And it seems to work, and these dogs just want to be really nice with us. They want to please us, and as soon as they figure out what's the way to please us, they do.
Okay, so let's get into what you learned here. When you say good boy to your dog, what exactly is going on in his brain? What did you find out?
Yeah, so we said good boy, but we also said good boy without the praising intonation. And to trick them a bit more, we also used meaningless conjunction verbs like however, nevertheless, in a praising intonation, and also some of these meaningless words in a normal intonation. So basically, we could test for the differences in the brain. So what are the brain regions which respond differently to praise words, meaningful words, and meaningless sound sequences, independently of intonation? And then, again, what are those brain regions which respond differently to praising intonation and a non-praising neutral intonation, independently of word meaning? And what we found is that brains of dogs separately process word meaning and intonational information. So the left hemisphere is more involved in processing meaningful words. So when they hear a meaningful word, the left hemisphere is more active than the right hemisphere. And when they hear meaningless sound sequences, meaningless words, then there is no difference between hemispheres. But for intonation, we found the right hemisphere auditory region, which responds differently to praising intonation and non-praising intonation. So basically, this showed that they can separate these two types of information from the speech signal. And what we also saw is that they can combine these two types of information in the so-called reward center. So dogs, just like humans, have a reward center in their brain. And this is a very cool place because you can you can just look at it, see when it's active, and then you can guess that the dog feels rewarded. So this reward center is active for food, just general food reward, or being petted, or for a hug, for a nice music in humans. And what we saw that for praise words in praising intonation, this reward center was active, but for praise words in neutral intonation or for neutral words in praising intonation, we saw no higher activation there than for neutral words in neutral intonation.
So, and is this pretty much what you expected to see?
It's an exciting question because in a way, we were really surprised that we have a brain pattern in dogs which is similar to that found in humans. On the other hand, we all have these anecdotes and these memories that we can sometimes use only our intonation or only some word meanings to our dogs, and it works. But what happens here is as if you were calling your dog on the phone. They only have the speech information. They don't see you. They don't see the body gestures. They don't have all the context. This is only word meaning and intonation which is at play here. So we were really surprised to see that they can, in this setting, actually use both of these types of cues.
So, Alexandre, tell me, first of all, as you listen to what Attila is saying, I mean, what do you think of a finding like this? And how does it jive with some of the things that you've learned about how dogs communicate with us and what they hear from us when we talk to them?
This is really fun research because it extends the boundaries of what's been happening in, I would say, the testing of social cognition in dogs. We've always known that dogs are very good at reading signals from us. As you said, the gestures, pointing, they're very sensitive to that, perhaps more sensitive than we sometimes are to dogs, communicative mm-hmm. signals. And the technique of using fMRI to give some evidence that there's a differentiation in their brain between the meaning and the tone of the word is surprising and new and really exciting.
So how do we know, though, Alexandra, that we're not just talking about animals that are very good at being trained to react to something we do versus comprehending in some way what we do? I mean, what's the difference?
Right. The question of whether they're understanding the words is, I think, still an open question. So there is no question that they're able to extract something, maybe the meaning, maybe that they recognize the familiar word. These meaningful words were all familiar words that they saw the left hemispheric activation in. So maybe they recognize that those are familiar, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily have the same kind of understanding as we would say a human would understand each other's words.
Attila, speech is something that's unique to humans. It doesn't exist in a dog's natural environment. Do you think that dogs can process human vocalizations?
It seems they can. They definitely process them in some way. And I very much agree with Alexandra that talking about understanding is a very, very interesting issue. And I never dare to use the word understanding, actually, because what we say is that they make differentiation between different types of stimuli. And what we see here now is that dog brains process words in a way similar to how human brains do. And this is very interesting also because of because of humans. If you think about what humans do and how special our neural mechanisms for speech processing are, if you look at it from that perspective, then I think it's really exciting. But I wouldn't dare to say that this is a proof that those really understand everything we say or even whatever we say.
A lot of people have questions and thoughts about their dogs. Let's go to the phones. And we've got Max, I believe it is, in Athens, Georgia. Hi, Max.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
Well, I have a question about my dog. She's a puppy. She's about 5 months old. And she knows her name. She knows some. She knows how to sit, shake hands, stuff like that. She's overall doing really well. And she does respond really well to praise. And she's very responsive to my voice. And my question, though, is that when she's doing something bad, like maybe she snatches something off the table that she's not supposed to have and then bolts across the room with it, it doesn't matter what inflection of my voice I use, she doesn't respond. Like, she ignores me. Like, I could understand her not wanting to come, you know, if I was scolding her. But even if I, you know, say her name in a really, really sweet voice, it's like she knows. And so I didn't know if there was, you know, some tip or trick that I could use to get her more responsive to when she's not doing well but is being bad.
Well, let's turn to Alexandra about this, because it's a great question. Thank you so much for that, Max.
I've done a lot of work on sort of that moment when the dog is doing something wrong and the question of whether the dog is understanding that they've done something wrong. And in fact, it looks like what happens in these situations is dogs really learn about you. What they learn is your body posture and your tone and how you're approaching them. And your words are undermined by what your behavior is. So the dog is probably, in that case, looking at your behavior. Even subtle behaviors you don't think indicate that you're angry. And therefore, even if the dog is maybe processing the word of their name or come, they're not going to come to you. I mean, basically, we have to have a richer vocabulary, I think, and use it consistently with dogs in different contexts if we want them to learn the specific meanings of words.
I've even read that, you know, that whole trick that we try to do where we go, come on, it'll be fun. Let's go to the vet. Come on. The dog can tell, you know, look, it's not time to go to the vet. I don't really want to go to the vet right now, right?
Absolutely. Dogs learn these associations much better than we think. They see where we're going before we're going there. As long as they live with us and follow our habits, I think they're kind of anthropologists in our homes watching us. So we can't be surprised when they know that they're actually going to the vet.
Yeah, and you, yeah, you that, go ahead, Attila. Yeah,
yeah, and I always get this question: what's special about dogs? And you know, this is what's special about dogs. I think that they care about what we communicate, what we want to communicate. They want to get something from our speech. And this is what makes them able to be to learn from our words. So yeah, they might not have a very different brain from other mammals, but they just live in the same environment. They got used to paying attention to us humans, so they have the opportunity to actually get familiarized with our words. They have the opportunity to learn much more from our speech than other animals who just don't care.
And they want to, Attila, get something from us, and they want to get those praising words. They want to get praising human behavior, yeah, Sometimes even more than food.
Yeah, we are relevant to them. Our reactions are relevant to dogs, yeah.
There's good research that shows that often praising can be as rewarding as food, so we should keep that in mind.
I want to go to Tim, who's calling from Mason City, Iowa. Let's go to Tim. Hi there, you're on Science Friday.
Hello, thank you.
Yeah.
I guess I had a golden retriever named Rusty. And I did a lot of complex cooking in my kitchen. So sometimes I would say, no dogs in the kitchen, very calmly. If I was kind of exasperated, I might say it more forcefully. But every time I said it, he would go, there was linoleum in the kitchen and then carpet in the dining living area with just an aluminum tack strip. And he would go and just put his front paws right on that aluminum tack strip. So he was out of the kitchen, but just barely, just by an inch or so. And I could also, when I had guests over and he started sniffing around and stuff like that, I'd say, Rusty, why don't you go to your room? And he would. He had his own room in the house. And also when I would say, do you want to go for a walk? He would go grab the leash.
Well, bring it over here.
You know, it's so. And Tim, thank you for sharing the stories too. And Attila, these are all things that, I mean, dog owners, I think because we all love our dogs so much, there are things that we assume dogs are hearing, and then there may be things that we can know that dogs are hearing. When you listen to Tim's story, what do you think Tim's dog was actually understanding or hearing that he was saying in the words kitchen or you know, let's go for a walk?
Yeah, I just guess that word was heard by the dog many times. So if a dog gets familiar with a word, with an expression, that it can associate something with that. And why not to use all the information which is in that speech signal? If it's not only intonation, but also the same word again and again, why not to use that if they have the brain capacity for that? Yeah.
And let's remember that they also, this particular dog also got rewarded by not having anyone scold at them anymore for doing just barely enough of what was asked. So what was really being asked is just barely go out of the kitchen, just barely go into the room. That's what the dog learned.
Sounds like an awful lot of humans I know. I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And let's go back to the phones. Mickey is in Portland, Oregon. Hi there, Mickey.
Hi. Alexandra, I love your book, Inside of a Dog. Thank you for writing it.
Thank you.
It was wonderful. Are you there?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, so my question is this. I've heard that dogs can tell which eye to look at. When they're looking at us, that they look at our left eye first and then our right, and this is how humans communicate with each other. And even, like, chimps and other primates don't do this. I'm wondering why dogs do that and what their motivation is for doing that. I mean, I think it's to bond with us and communicate with us, but I'm really not sure. So I'd like to hear your views.
Thanks very much.
You're right that dogs are supremely sensitive to the gaze and face of humans more than any other non-human animal. And that's probably what subserves and makes available they're learning from our face and our gaze. And there has been this interesting lateralization work. In fact, this latest research is similar to some of it, where you look at do dogs do something more with one side of their brain or the other, one nostril or the other. And in this case, they do look first at the left part of a face, research has shown, just like humans do. So that might be a coincidence. In other words, other animals might have similar lateralization patterns if they're social animals, something that we both have evolved separately. And it might be that it turns out that in living with us for thousands of years, dogs have evolved a kind of special sensitivity to the components of our face that are meaningful. And that's why they look there.
Mm. And I think it's actually something new, because when we did research with the hand-raised wolves, where my colleagues earlier some years ago, they found that those wolves, even if they learn a lot of things about human family, they don't look back at humans. So this is a big difference between dogs and wolves, that wolves will not look back at you, and dogs keep the eye contact much longer, much easier.
And Attila, that was something I did want to ask you about your study. I mean, you've got these dogs in the MRI machine who are very, very well trained, clearly are very responsive to humans. I mean, if you were able to get a wolf in a machine like that, do you think you'd see something quite a bit different?
No, I don't think I would see very much of a difference, because the fact that we find very similar brain mechanisms for speech processing in dogs and humans, that tells me that it's probably a brain mechanism which was there in the last common ancestor of dogs and humans some 100 million years ago. So I would guess that we could find it in other mammals. Yeah, once anyone is able to train them to stay there motionless and being attentive, yeah.
Very quickly, Alexandra, how much do we know about how dogs communicate through their barks? I mean, we hear a bark and we don't know what's in that bark. What do we know about the bark?
Right. I'd say that a bark is actually a minority of their communication to us, but it's one that maybe even evolved as a kind of response to the barking, the speech that we do. And there have been studies that show that even people who are not owners of dogs can distinguish between many, handful, six or eight types of barks used in different contexts.
Alexandra Horowitz, psychology professor at the Dog Cognition Lab, thank you so much for joining us. Attila Andic, who joined us from Budapest, Hungary, thank you so much. You can read more about dogs and watch our video from the Westminster Dog Show on our website at sciencefriday.com/dogs. Coming up, we're going to talk about Lucy. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. It's being described as the cracking of a 3.2 million year old cold case, how Lucy, the famed fossil skeleton of an early human ancestor, may have died by falling out of a tree. The clues? New high-resolution CT scans of her bones. The research out of the University of Texas has been disputed by some anthropologists, including some who have worked extensively on Lucy in the past. More about that in just a bit. When we saw this paper, it made us curious. What are the stories that bones are telling us about our ancient human relatives? And how do we know they're true? How are new technologies expanding what we can know about how they lived and how our singular branch sprung from the tree? Here to trace the science behind the stories of our millions-year-old kin are my guests, John Hawks, first a professor of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. John Hawks, welcome back to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Great to be here, as always.
And if you want to join us, our phone number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. So tell us about your reaction to this paper. We're now hearing that Lucy may have died from a hard impact, possibly falling out of a tree. What's the evidence that's being pointed to here?
Well, the team who analyzed the bones got to scan them for the first time because the bones came to the United States on tour, and they took them into a high-resolution scanner at the University of Texas, and they spent a lot of time reconstructing the fragments of the bones. And on Lucy's upper right arm, her humerus, that upper right arm bone, has got the head of it, the side that connects to your shoulder, sort of punched into the bone, and the outsides of it is sort of crushed outwards. And people have seen that since they found the fossil, and they sort of assumed, well, this is damage that probably happened after it was fossilized, as it was, you know, underground, under high pressure. But the team of John Kappelman and his colleagues looked at it, and they said, you know, this looks funny to us. It looks like the kind of break that you see when somebody is thrusting out their arm to stop a fall. And that was where they really started their detective work. They looked across the rest of the skeleton. They found some other breaks that they thought were indicative of breakage that happened around the time of death, not healed breaks. We can tell when there's signs of healing, but something that wasn't healed but happened when the bones were possibly still fresh. So that was where they went to say, hey, something happened here, and it's really, you know, something we need to explain.
So there has been some criticism of this research, and you've asked some questions yourself. Why is there a debate over this?
I think part of it is, you know, people really feel like they know this fossil. Here's a fossil that's been out of the ground for more than 40 years. And, you know, when you've got this iconic image of something, especially the folks who've worked on it for a long time, what's really unusual is when a new study comes out that says, hey, I found something new. And the people who've known these things for 40 years say, hey, no, no way, that can't be. And you look at that and say, what's going on here? There is a lot of damage that happens to fossils when they're buried in the ground and fossilized. As that process of mineralization is happening, they're buried under tons of sediment. And what you want to see in a case like this is that there's been a comparison made to other fossils of other kinds of animals that are found along with these fossils. And you say, oh, okay, this pattern is either like the other fossilization damage or it's different. In this case, the paper didn't have that kind of information. So it made people, you know, like me included, very skeptical.
So there's not CT scans of bones from other animals found just around the site?
Exactly. The thing is that you look at that and you say, wow, you know, this is like a forensic case. And the first thing you do if you want to prove that something is, you know, a gunshot is look at a lot of gunshots and other kinds of things. It's like you watch CSI. They're going to shoot a gun into the ballistic gel and show, okay, we can recognize this pattern. And that's what hasn't been done in this case. Understandably, right? Because we don't go running all kinds of animal fossils through high-resolution CT scanners all the time. But it's one of those things that as the technology progresses, we demand more and more evidence to document what we're finding.
I want to bring into our conversation Tracy Kivel, who's a paleoanthropologist at the University of Kent in the UK. She focuses specifically on hand bones, which we'll talk about in just a moment. Tracy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
First of all, I want to ask, what would it tell us, do you think, about Lucy's species or anything about the time she lived if it turns out she really did fall out of a tree?
Well, I guess it would, there are many aspects about Lucy's skeleton and many other early fossil humans that suggest that they were potentially, they said they had the potential to climb in trees, but it's been a huge debate in our field basically since Lucy was discovered, whether or not the features of her skeleton that suggest she was climbing in trees were actually something that she was using, or were they, you know, or were these just sort of relics or retentions from a more arboreal ancestor. So the idea that potentially this evidence that she actually did, evidence of this actual behavior is quite helpful.
So in your work, Tracy, you look specifically at the anatomy of the hand and fossil hand bones. So mm-hmm. what sorts of questions can a hand answer? What can you learn from a hand?
Well, I think the hands are exciting because they can tell us about two big questions in human evolution. We use potentially whether or not we're using our hands for climbing in trees and suspending in trees, and you know how long into our human evolutionary history did we do that, and when did we stop using our hands for locomotion and become fully committed to walking on 2 feet on the ground. But it also can tell us about when we use tools or when we began to use tools, and when, you know, a human hand is very well known for our dexterity. But we don't know exactly when that dexterity evolved and when we started to use tools and to make tools. And so our hands are directly involved in both of those big questions about human evolution.
If we look at Lucy as an example, what do her hand bones tell us about how she lived or what she did?
Well, that we have lots of hand bones for Lucy's species, but unfortunately, we don't have sort of articulated or a hand skeleton that belongs to one individual, which means that we are a little bit more limited in what we can say about what Lucy may have done with her hands. But we can put together sort of a composite skeleton of the hand, and when we do that, we can tell that potentially her fingers were a little bit longer relative to the length of her thumb than in a human hand. They weren't as long as she didn't have quite as long fingers as we see in a chimpanzee or bonobo, but her fingers seem to be a little bit longer potentially than ours are, which is an indication that maybe she was still spending at least some time in the trees. And also her finger bones are a little bit more curved than humans. And both of those things are an indication that she had the potential to spend some time climbing in trees.
If you've got questions about Lucy, this famous human ancestor, 844-724-8255 or 844 Sci-Talk. John Hawks, you were one of the anthropologists looking at a large cache of fossils found in South Africa last year that turned out to be a completely new species of human ancestor. Could you walk us through the treatment of those bones and that discovery a little bit?
Sure. You know, we were, you know, obviously immensely lucky. We did not expect that in the Rising Star Cave we were going to find, you know, what turned out to be a cache of at least 15 hominin individuals, at least 1,500 fossil specimens that we've found there so far. And that was really a remarkable thing. To analyze those, you know, you think of, you know, we've got discoveries in our field where people work on the discovery literally for decades, where you have, you know, so many things you want to do. You want to compare it to every other fossil that we've ever found. You want to have high-resolution scanning done. You want to have experts look at that stuff. We brought in a team of more than 50 people around the world to analyze these fossils. We've done some high-resolution surface scanning of them. We've been doing micro-CT scanning of the material. We brought in experts like Tracy who work on different elements of the anatomy. We really did this all in parallel, which was a fun process, you know, because we got to see the insights that people were developing who've studied the hand for their whole lives or studied, you know, the teeth and put together that sort of picture. The cool thing about it was, you know, being able to apply technology and being able to apply different expertise all at once, you discover things that you wouldn't have expected otherwise. The hand is sort of a cool story with Homo naledi, because the wrist bones, the fingertips, all these things are very human-like. But the fingers, like in Lucy's species are relatively curved, and that makes us think that Homo naledi was probably climbing to some extent, even though it had a lot of human-like elements to its hands.
I'm wondering if Tracy could quickly pick up on some of what we learned about the hands from that discovery.
Yes, yeah. As John mentioned, well, first, we were extremely, extremely lucky. It's an amazing source of fossils. But yeah, there is one aspect of the luckiness is basically that we found a hand that was basically in articulation. So we know it belongs to a particular individual, and that allows us to say a lot more about the hand function than just trying to piece together bits and bobs from different individuals. And as John said, the fingers are really quite remarkably curved. They're even more curved than what we see in Lucy, which is quite surprising, given the very human-like aspects of some of the other parts of her skeleton. And within the hand, there are aspects of the wrist and the thumb that show features that we only see in humans and Neanderthals. And these features, they basically, most of them relate to sort of a reorientation of the way of our wrist and how our wrist accommodates sort of high stress that happens when we manipulate objects during things like tool use and tool making. And those features that we see in those changes that we see in humans and Neanderthals have been interpreted as being adaptations to sort of a commitment to stone tool use and making complex stone tools. And we see those adaptations in Homo naledi, but in combination with these really curved fingers. So it's this sort of completely different signals in different aspects of the hand skeleton.
I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Tracy, it sounds like we can learn so much about our ancestors from hands, but you face a lot of challenges being a hand expert, don't you?
Yes. Until Lee Berger and his team discovered the Homo naledi and the new species Australopithecus sediba, which was discovered a few years ago as well in South Africa, we really had a very limited fossil record in terms of hand bones. At least in terms of hand skeletons, that it was always, for the most part, fragmentary remains from isolated bones that for which we didn't know whether they belonged to the same individual, and most of the time we didn't even know what species they belonged to, and so it has been quite difficult to sort of say something more sort of concrete about the evolution of hand use. That's thankfully, these new discoveries are making my job a lot easier.
Well, I would assume, John Hawks, that something that would make everyone's job a lot easier is if you could just scan more bones like this. Why aren't all of these bones scanned, and what are some of the challenges to doing that?
Well, you know, the technology has progressed a lot, but you know, 15 years ago, the state of the art was, I'm going to scan one bone, or maybe a skull, and we'll accurately estimate the size of the inside of it or something. You know, the technology is progressing, but also when we deal with human evolution, we find these fossils in many different countries, all of which have heritage issues that they want to make sure that they're responsible custodians of their country's heritage. Museums are involved, and they want to make sure that, you know, as they're curating these objects, they're, you know, being responsible in it. And we today in science are much more about sharing than was ever true in the past. You know, right? Today the state of the art is you put your data online when you publish your paper that describes it. You know, it's that thing of people should be able to look at your data. But when you deal with heritage objects, there's a lot of times this instinct that's sort of like art history, you know, like the museum has this thing and you want to make sure that, you know, any possible rights to photographs of the thing are, you know, conserved appropriately and so on. We're moving into a realm where people are more used to the idea of sharing data openly, where having a data set of scans is something that is essential to do new work on new fossils. And I think that the field is changing, but it's one where that process of change is still happening. It's a great progress this week that the team that scanned Lucy released a few of the bones as models online so people can look at these and can print them out. And I think that we're going to see more and more of that.
Are there other technologies that you think, John, would make your life, your job easier, where you could make some new discoveries if just you had that one thing?
I'll tell you what, if you had a device like a tricorder from Star Trek that could look into rocks and see what was inside of them, that would make a lot of difference. I've got to say, we learn so much from new techniques. You know, things like doing micro sampling of the calculus, that tartar that builds up on teeth. And we find evidence of ancient plants inside of that, the plants that individuals were eating. And so you learn about diet that way. You know, we scan with a synchrotron, super high energy x-rays through these fossils and create very high resolution images of teeth. And you can see the growth increments in the teeth. Technology makes a difference to this. But a lot of what we do is just going out in the field and looking and looking and looking. You know, the discovery at Rising Star was a couple of guys who were avocational cavers who said, can we help look for things? And by God, the first cave they went into looking, they found something incredible.
Tracy, we just have a few seconds. Do you have something that you'd love to see next that would help you do your job?
Ooh, a time machine. That would be helpful. But that would answer a lot of questions.
I was going to say, a time machine, I know some people are working on that. We might not get that anytime soon. But I want to thank our guest, Tracy Kivel, a paleoanthropologist at the University of Kent in the UK. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And thanks also to John Hawks, a professor of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Attention New Yorkers, Science Friday and Studio 360 are getting together on September 27th at WNYC's The Green Space to celebrate the legacy of the Voyager Golden Record. Join Ira, Kurt Anderson, and Brain Pickings' Maria Popova for a night of live music and cosmic conversation. More info at sciencefriday.com/goldenrecord. Charles Bergquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Rich Kim is our technical director, and Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers at the controls at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. You can send us an email. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. In New York, I'm John Dankosky.